We today are going to be talking about the garments for the priests. And also we're going to start talking about sacrifices, different types of sacrifices. Brian has done an excellent job in explaining to us the tabernacle, all of the specifics about, you know, the measurements and the furniture and all the material and exactly precisely how it's to be made according to the pattern. And Moses did that according to the pattern. But it's not just the tabernacle that had a pattern. It's also, like we're going to talk about today, the clothing that the priests wore, the sacrifices that were to be offered. There was a pattern there. Everything had a pattern that had to be followed precisely. Okay? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. But before we can talk about the garments, we need to talk about the priests themselves. Okay? The priests were mediators. God ordained that there be priests to mediate between himself and the people. From the time that sin first entered the world, God no longer walked and talked freely with man. So he did with Adam and Eve in the garden, right? But once sin entered the picture, it wasn't God dealing directly with man. He would use a mediator for that. Of course, Moses was a mediator between God and the people, but now it's going to be the priest in this official capacity. All right. By the days of Cain and Abel, God had ordained that men approach him by means of a sacrifice. All right. During the patriarchal era or age or whatever you want to call it, you know, the days of like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, during the patriarchal era, the father of each family offered sacrifices for his own family. Okay, so think about Job and Job chapter 1. Do you remember what Job did? He offered sacrifices for his sons and daughters in case any of them had sinned. All right? That's what we see in the patriarchal time. Now, in the law of Moses, God is setting apart specific men, these priests, who will serve as mediators between himself and the people. All right? So the intercessory nature of the work of the priest is set forth in several ways. First of all, Aaron is said to bear the names of the tribes of Israel twice in the description of the garments. Okay, I want you to, for example, I want us to read in Exodus 28 and verse 12. Exodus 28 and verse 12. By the way, I've got a ton of stuff to cover today. So I may not give as many opportunities for a whole lot of comments, but we will allow for that. But I've got to make sure and cover material because I've got a ton of material to cover Wednesday too. And I don't want to get behind and put Brian behind. So in Exodus 28 and verse 12, we're talking here about the onyx stones that were on the shoulder pieces of the ephod. Okay, verse 12, you shall put the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of memorial for the sons of Israel, and Aaron shall bear the names before the Lord on his two shoulders for a memorial. Now that's symbolic. This bearing of the names of the tribes of Israel was the idea that Aaron is bearing the people. In the sense that he's going to God on behalf of the people. Okay? It's very interesting. In chapter 28 and verse 29, we see that same concept with on the front of the ephod, there was the breastplate or the breast piece, and it had different stones that were on it, 12 stones that had the names of the children of Israel. Verse 29, Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breast piece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place for a memorial before the Lord continually. So he's carrying their names. Okay, again, symbolic that he's bearing the people. Okay, so we'll talk more about the details of the garments in just a minute, but I wanted to go ahead and point that out here. That's so significant. All right? When God gave instructions about the work of the priests and the Levites, he said that he chose the Levites to become his special tribe in place of what? Or in place of whom? The firstborn. Okay? In place of the firstborn that God had claimed as his own after the last plague in Egypt. That's just something we need to know up front as we go into this study. It's interesting. The sacrifices to be offered under the law of Moses were very complex. It wasn't like the days of the patriarchs, right? These were very complex, very specific, and therefore it required to have people, these priests who were dedicated to doing this full time. that could know all the ins and outs and could offer up these holy things to the Lord with their full attention. So that's what the role of the priests were. The priests also were commanded to be teachers, to teach Israel all the statutes of the Lord. So they're not just people who just make sacrifices, right? And just make sacrifices and put on these garments and make sacrifices. They are also actively involved in teaching the people the statutes of the Lord. So they have to know all the statutes of the Lord. It was their task to keep charge of the sanctuary and the charge of the altar. All right. Now, in the book of Hebrews, we read that the high priest is bound as for the people, so also for himself to offer for sins. So he's offering sacrifices on behalf of the people, for them. He's their mediator. He's their intercessor. He's also offering sacrifices for himself, but also for the people. In Hebrews 7, in verse 25, we have perhaps one of the clearest passages about the intercessory role of priests, because we read that Jesus ever lives to make intercession for them, for us. Okay? So Jesus does that for us. The priest would do that for, priests would do that for the people. Okay? All right. The role of the priests was very important in God's whole scheme of how he was doing things under the law of Moses. They stood between God and the people. Now think about how important that is. Because God's not dealing with them directly. So if you're the person, I just want you to just picture this. If you're the person between God and the people, would that be a big honor?
Yes.
Yes, but what else would it be? Okay. Yes, it would be a huge, heavy responsibility. I'll just tell you, I'm not a priest, because there are no specific priests in the role. We're all a holy priesthood in the New Testament. But being an evangelist, that's a big responsibility. It's a huge responsibility. To be a shepherd, an elder, is a huge responsibility. But I don't even think that holds a candle to the huge responsibility that the priests had. Okay? It's a big job. The high priest even stood as the supreme court if a matter of wrong was done that was too difficult for the local judges and the officials to handle. So this was a big job. Now, God was quite specific in saying that the priests themselves were to be what specific people within the tribe of Levi? All right, so Aaron would be the high priest. His sons would be priests. Do you remember his sons? Four of them. All right. Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Okay. And then his direct descendants. So those would be the only ones of the Levites who would be priests. They had to come from Aaron. Okay. That's just some basics that we need to know. Before we get into talking about their garments, we need to make sure we understand what priests are. Okay. So now we start talking about the garments. Does anybody have any comments, any brief comments? I know I told you I'm kind of in a hurry, but does anybody have anything to add or any questions, important questions to ask at this point?
The high priest was the guy with all power.
Okay, yes.
And we have a high priest too.
Oh, yes. Yes, we have a high priest, don't we? And that is our Lord, Jesus Christ. Very good. Okay? So the garments for the high priest. So we read about the garments for the high priest in chapters 28 and chapter 39. Let's start reading in chapter 28, and let's read verses 1 through 3. Then bring near to yourself Aaron, your brother. I know everybody says Aaron, but it has two A's. Two A's. Aaron. Okay, it doesn't matter. Then bring near to yourself Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the sons of Israel to minister as priest to me. Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. You shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty. Look at those two things. For glory and for beauty. You shall speak to all the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom And they shall make Aaron's garments to consecrate him that he may minister as priest to me. Now, it is Aaron's garments, the garments of the high priest, that are described in the most detail. Okay? And just like we did with when we talked about the tabernacle, when Brian talked about that, we saw there were two sections. You had one section was the instructions, and one section which was where they're putting it all together. Same thing with the garments. So we're just putting those two sections together to make it concise and simple in our study today. So the Lord told Moses, let's read chapter 28, verses 4 and 5 there, the next two verses. These are the garments which they shall make, a breastpiece and an ephod and a robe and a tunic of checkered work, a turban and a sash, and they shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, and for his sons, that he may minister as priest to me. They shall take the gold and the blue and the purple and the scarlet material and the fine linen. Okay? Now, as God would go forth from here to list the garments, he listed them from the outermost garment in, but we're going to start with innermost and go out because it's the simplest garment is first, and we're just going to do it that way. Okay? So, here you have the basic outfit, and the first is the linen undergarment. Now, that's not on the picture, so you can't see that one, but these linen breeches, as it says in the book, and, you know, I'm from Alabama, we don't say breeches, we say britches. And when I think of britches, I just think of, you know, some drawers, you just pull it out. But this was underwear that would reach from their waist to their thighs. It was designed to cover their nakedness. They were forbidden to enter the tabernacle or approach the altar without this garment on, lest they incur guilt and die. Can you imagine? Like, if you don't put on exactly the right undergarment, then you're gone. You're a goner. So this is a huge deal. Every piece of the garment had to be, every piece of their outfit had to be perfect, perfectly followed and obeyed. All right, the second was the coat. All right, this was the first garment that was worn over the underwear, and it was made of fine linen and woven in some kind of pattern. No other details are given in the text about this coat. And I don't want to just go on and on. We could just talk about what historians say. It was a coat, okay? So it may have been white and had some design, but we're not sure, okay? Next was the robe, okay? Over the coat, the high priest wore a robe. And what color was the robe? All right, it was made of blue. And interestingly, at the bottom, there was this these pomegranates, which were obviously circular in shape. The pomegranates were of blue and purple and scarlet. They alternated with what? Gold bells. And we're not told the significance of this, but when Aaron would be doing his intercessory work, you could hear him. You could hear the bells jingling wherever he went. And that seems to maybe be something that would, you know, heighten your senses. Pay attention, and you know what's going on back there, that Aaron is doing this intercessory work. So that's just fascinating to me. That's just really interesting to me. All right, then what was the next? What went over the robe? The ephod, okay? The ephod. This article was worn only by the high priest, all right? An onyx stone fastened it in a setting of gold to each shoulder piece, and the stones, as we said earlier from 28 and verse 12, were engraved with what? What do they have on them?
Tribe names.
The names of the tribes of Israel. And Aaron was bearing the names on his shoulders. You know, we even talk about today, you know, bearing something on your shoulders. And so that's the idea here. The fabric of the ephod was of fine twisted linen interwoven with threads of blue, purple, and scarlet. And what else was interwoven?
Gold.
Now, we don't mean like golden colored threads. We're talking about threads that were made out of gold that was hammered out and it was cut into these strips and interwoven into the... Can you imagine having literal gold in the garments that you wear?
It might be heavy.
It might be a little heavy. All right, a sash called a skillfully woven band. The King James Version says a curious girdle. was woven into one piece with the ephod. It too was made of the same material. Okay? Two chains of gold held the breast piece or the breastplate in place. So we're going to talk next about the breast piece or the breast plate. Okay? This was the most important part of the high priest's attire. It's called the breastplate of what? Of judgment. Okay? Aaron was to wear it when he went in and went out before the Lord. It was made of the same mingled colors as the ephod. The fabric of the breastplate was formed into a perfect 9-inch square, a span, which is the distance between the thumb and the pinky. Okay, 9 inches. And it was folded double to form a pocket. And what was kept inside that pocket?
The Urim and the Thummim.
All right? And I've always said Urim and Thummim. I have no idea how to pronounce it. So Thummim, Thummim. We'll talk more about that in just a second. Four rows of three precious stones each were set in gold settings upon the breastplate. Engraved upon these 12 stones were what? The names. Okay? He's bearing them. He's bearing them over his heart. I think that, I mean, that is signified in Scripture. So that's something that's very symbolic. This is very near and dear to his heart and his love for the people. And he was bearing them. He was carrying them. Okay? By the way, we're not going to turn there, but in Revelation 21 and verse 12, in the description of the New Jerusalem and that holy city, it had 12 gates. And what is similar with those gates and what we read about here? Okay, so we have engraved upon them the names of the 12 tribes. And so the background of that passage from Revelation is here in this passage. So we're going to make connections like that that are very fascinating. If you really want to understand the New Testament, brethren, you've got to understand the Old Testament. You can't just say, well, I'm not going to study the Old Testament. And it's all these details and all that stuff. We're not under that anymore. If you don't understand the Old Testament, I hope I don't, you know, come across as too passionate about this, but I am. If you don't understand the Old Testament, then when you read your New Testament, you're going to have a partial, limited, shallow understanding. We have to study the whole Bible. The whole thing, start to finish. We don't just study the New Testament. We got to learn the Old Testament too. Right?
That was the way God could with his people and yeah. How he deals with
them. Yes, yes. Good point, Mr. Bill. Okay. All right, so it's uncertain what the Urim and the Thummim were. I kind of like that pronunciation better. The terms are used very few times in the Bible. Do you remember from your study preparing for class what the book says, what the words Urim and Thummim actually mean?
Lights and perfections.
There you go. Lights and perfections. So that's just interesting. The first letter of Urim starts with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and the first letter of Thummim starts with the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So if some people try to place some significance to that, I'm not sure. I just don't like to just wade into speculation because there's things we just don't know. But these were some sort of device by which the high priest could do what? Speak for God. Give a yes or no answer. So it could have been like two stones. There are two different colors, and one would be yes and one would be no. We don't know exactly what it was. But it was very significant that this would be God communicating through the Urim and the Thummim to be able to tell the people in matters where a question was brought up, what does God say, yes or no here? The priest could tell you. And so thus, in a way, the priest was also acting as a prophet. All right? Final piece of the high priest's outfit was his headgear, the turban. And so it was made of fine linen, which means it was white. On the front of the turban was a gold plate. In fact, let's just read in chapter 28, verses 36, starting. 36 to 38, we'll read that. I just find this very fascinating and profound. You shall also make a plate of pure gold and shall engrave on it like the engravings of a seal, holy to the Lord. You shall fasten it on a blue cord, and it shall be on the turban, it shall be at the front of the turban. All right, now here he had on his forehead, holy to the Lord. You think that would be significant? That's significant. Verse 38, it shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall take away the iniquity of the holy things which the sons of Israel consecrate with regard to all their holy gifts, and it shall always be on his forehead that they may be accepted before the Lord. Very, very significant. Holy to the Lord. I mean, in a sense, we as priests in the new covenant should have holy to the Lord on our forehead. And it should define our role, and we should wear it all the time. So there's a lot of lessons that we could, you know, we could make here. Okay. So that's the garments for the high priest. Now the garments for the priest was not as exciting. Okay? A lot of the similar clothing, but more simple. And so let's just read there in chapter 28, starting in verse 40. For Aaron's sons you shall make tunics. You shall also make sashes for them, and you shall make caps for them, for glory and for beauty. You shall put them on Aaron your brother, and on his sons with him, and you shall anoint them and ordain them and consecrate them that they may serve me as priests. You shall make for them linen breeches to cover their bare flesh, and they shall reach from the loins even to the thighs. They shall be on Aaron and on his sons when they enter the tent of meeting, or when they approach the altar to minister in the holy place, so that they do not incur guilt and die. It shall be a statute forever to him and to his descendants after him. And so the clothing for the priest is only part of what Aaron, the high priest, would wear. It would be very simple. Pretty much, their outfit was all white. So they had the turban on their head, and they had the robe. And so it was white, except for what? The sash, which was of the same material that we were talking about earlier, that was interwoven with the gold thread and so forth. Okay? It's interesting, when you go to the New Testament, Revelation chapter 1, and you start reading about this depiction of the glorified Christ, what's he wearing? A white robe and a sash. Only his sash wasn't interwoven with gold. What was it? It was pure gold. And he didn't have a white turban on his head. Instead, what do you have on his head? White hair. And so you see the connections from the Old Testament to even the vision of the glorified Christ, that you understand it so much more. He's our intercessor. And that's part of the vision there in Revelation chapter 1. Bill, hold on. I'm sorry. Hold on 1 second. I'll take some comments in just a minute. All right. So I want to point out two things. Two things that we can learn about. We could probably point out 22 things or 122 things. But one thing is, God cares about details. We see that not only in the tabernacle and the tabernacle furniture and every detail of the design, and it was to be done according to the pattern. We're going to talk about that in this morning's lesson. But also, the clothing, even down to the thread. God is a God of pattern, and He cares about the details. Right? That's the whole thing we learn from His character in the Old Testament, and especially in this part of the Old Testament. Second major lesson I just want to point out here, and I'm not going to go too deep with this or take it too far, but we also are priests. 1 Peter 2:5, we're a holy priesthood. In fact, we even offer up spiritual sacrifices, according to that verse. And if God cared about the way His priests dressed in the Law of Moses, does He care at all how we dress as priests in the New Covenant? I think we could say yes. Now, how specific do we need to get with that in terms of, well, that means when you come to church, you need to wear a tie or you're not pleasing to the Lord. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to try to go there. In fact, in the book of James, if a brother comes in and he's just wearing old beat-up clothing, don't put him in the back seat. You know, give him the seat in the front. And so, if somebody's wearing whatever the best is that they have to wear, and that's the best they have to wear, we're not to judge that person if it doesn't live up to our standards. I'm simply saying, I think that God cares what we wear because we are priests before Him. And it wasn't just they did this once in a while when they went to the tabernacle. The priests were always at the tabernacle. This was their full-time work. They were always dressed in a way that would glorify and honor God. Do you think that there's a principle there for us as priests today? Are we part-time priests? We're full-time. God always cares how we present ourselves to His glory. Okay? And so, I've got an article I wrote about the way we dress. way we need to dress, in today's bulletin. Please, please, please read it. I wanted to preach the lesson, actually, but instead I wrote it as an article. Please read that. Okay. Now I will pause for comments. Anybody have a comment, Brian, and then Bill?
Yeah, I love that verse about the purpose of the clothes is for glory and for beauty.
Yes.
I remember Jenny had a great question on Wednesday about, you know, what if God's obsession with gold? And we had several ideas, and I think they were all good, but I forgot and didn't realize until I looked at this. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
There's an attractive,
yes,
beautiful nature of, yes, God that we learn about even in the priest's clothing, and as you suggested, even the spiritual application, the way we live is our clothing,
right,
as well. And
right,
we should live lives that attract people to God,
yes,
and don't repel them. You have the scary nature of God, but you also have the very beautiful nature.
Yes, and what we, you know, yes, and what we are to put on, as Paul talked about with Timothy, about the attire of women, we are to adorn ourselves with good works. And everything that we are to do is to be to the glory of God. We are to be lights, right? And so even the way we dress, that's important. It's overlooked, especially in Orlando, Florida. It's overlooked. I'm not talking about people putting on too much clothes. I'm talking about people taking off too much clothes, right? And so we can talk about that. That's actually what my article is about, which is why I want you to read it. Let me do Mr. Bill first and then Mr. Jack.
The high priest was dressed like this, I think, because he entered into the highest place when he went in to offer things for the children.
Okay, so he was dressed in a different way because he was in a higher role.
He was in a very, very high role.
Yes, very good.
And, of course, our high priest is Jesus.
Yes.
And he was not of that order.
Right, right. So the way that the high priest was dressed set him apart.
Yes.
And, of course, Jesus is set apart by
and Jesus made, the high priest had to make a sacrifice for himself,
yes,
as well as the people.
Yes.
Our priest made a sacrifice once,
right,
for all.
Of himself. Yeah. Very good. Jack?
I just wanted to point out that the ephod evidently had some additional powers because when David was in Keilah, he had an ephod brought to him, the ephod, I would assume, it says an ephod. And he and God had a conversation there. He asked God questions, God gave answers. He asked more questions, God gave answers. Mm-hmm. And David, on the basis of the information he received, he fled the city. Mm-hmm. It saved the city. I'm sure Saul would have... I think he ended up killing the priest.
Yes. So David having this conversation while he has the ephod, and the communication was being, I think, communicated to him through the Urim and the Thummim.
Yes.
Or Thummim. I think that would be the indication. Very good. Okay. Very good comments, y'all. I have to throw in y'all once in a while, guys. I mean, it's just me, and if I didn't do that, if I said you guys all the time, it wouldn't be me. So I have to say y'all. All right. So now we're going to talk about rules for the sacrifices. So we're changing topics totally. We're going to be talking about this for the rest of today and for all of Wednesday night and for next Sunday morning's class as well. Okay? That's our plan. And so we're going to be in this area talking about this topic for a while. Okay? This is really super fascinating stuff. Super helpful. A lot of applications for us as Christians and Jesus being our one-time offering and us making spiritual sacrifices and being living sacrifices. I mean, there's just so much. All right? So let's first kind of set up some basic stuff here. Sacrifices to God have been part of God's law for the people since sin first entered the world. But there are no rules recorded for the sacrifices that were offered under the patriarchal era, as I was talking about earlier. And so there's no rules that are recorded about that. It's evident from the event with Cain and Abel that God had given rules. How do we kind of deduce that?
Well,
how do we infer that?
By faith.
Yes, that Abel offered a sacrifice that was pleasing to God by faith, Hebrews 11 talks about. Well, if it was by faith, where does faith come from?
Hearing.
Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the Word of God. So God had to have communicated something for Abel to be able to offer his sacrifice by faith, but we are not given the information that must have been communicated there. Okay? The sacrifices under the patriarchal era were offered under a variety of circumstances. Okay? So these sacrifices might be to call upon the name of the Lord, or to confirm a covenant, or to offer a burnt offering, or perhaps other purposes as well. But God did not choose to leave these instructions for us. However, once we get to the law of Moses, we've got very specific, detailed instructions about how these sacrifices are to be done, what kind of sacrifices were to be offered. And as we said earlier, everything had to be done according to the pattern with these sacrifices. Okay? So, having said that, let's now talk about the types of sacrifices and how many sacrifices, types of sacrifice, major classes or categories of sacrifices are there. Anybody count them up? There are five. Okay? Now this is really a relief. There's only five you really need to remember. Okay? First one is burnt offerings. Secondly, meal offerings. We're going to just touch on those today. Okay? Thirdly is peace offerings. Fourth is sin offerings. Fifth, trespass offerings. You might be saying, well, what's all that? Well, don't start asking me questions about all that, because we're going to talk about it for the next three classes, or two classes after this one. Okay? But let's just start with the first one. Now, let me just mention this, though. Under each major category, there are more specific offerings described. For example, under the major heading of peace offerings, there were thanksgiving offerings, vow offerings, and free will or voluntary offerings. But those are all examples of peace offerings. So we're going to see that as we go along, that you can kind of divide these up and get more complex. But it all comes down to these five basic types. So isn't that nice? Burnt offerings, meal offerings, peace offerings, sin offerings, trespass offerings. Okay? It's probably good to just memorize that. All right, so first let's start with burnt offerings. Leviticus chapter 1. I want to turn to Leviticus. For the first time now, we're turning away from the book of Exodus and really going to dive into Leviticus. Well, why are we doing that? Why are we going to be studying Leviticus when we're studying about the Exodus? Yes. I want you to look at the very last verse of the book of Leviticus. That's the first thing I want you to do. This is kind of a side note to what I'm trying to really go to in Leviticus. I just want to establish something first. Look in Leviticus chapter 27 and verse 34. Leviticus chapter 27 and verse 34. Okay? These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at where? Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai. So that's where we are in the history of the narrative of the Bible. They're at Mount Sinai. So Leviticus fits in the overall period of the Exodus. Let me just explain something. When we say Exodus, we can be talking about the book of Exodus, or we can be talking about the period of the Exodus. Now, the way that Waldron defines the period of the Exodus is the Israelites making forward progress coming out of the land. Okay? Now, once they stop making that forward progress, they're no longer going forth. The word Exodus means a going forth. So once we get to Numbers chapter 13 and the Israelites send in the spies that come back with a fearful report, and then God commands the people to wander in the wilderness, well, guess what happened to the Exodus? Stop. It's over. Now it's a new period. It's the wandering in the wilderness. Okay? But the period of the Exodus is the book of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers 1 through 13. Okay? So, Leviticus is within this overall period of the Exodus. All right, now in Leviticus chapter... Look in Leviticus chapter 16. Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 24. Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 24. It tells us the purpose, one of the purposes of burnt offerings. Okay, Leviticus 16, 24 says, he, that's talking about Aaron, shall bathe his body with water in a holy place and put on his clothes and come forth and offer his burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people and make atonement for himself and for the people. That's a very important word. atonement. The etymology of the English word means at-one-ment. And that's not just a cute little thing. That's actually the etymology of the word, at-one-ment. The way that the nation would become at one with God was through appeasing God. God required what because of sin? Death. Okay? And when that animal was offered, then God was appeased. And we have at-one-ment happening. We have atonement occurring as a result. Okay? All right. So that's one of the purposes. The burnt offering was the most ancient of sacrifices. This, it seems apparent, was the very kind of sacrifice that Abel offered in Genesis 4, verse 4. The animal was completely burned in a burnt offering except for the hide. And where did the hide go? Who did the hide go to? The hide went to the priest, okay, who prepared the sacrifice. You guys did your homework, right? Everybody did your homework. All right, the word translated burnt offering, what does it mean? All right, good. A going up. So the word olah, the Hebrew word, means neither burnt nor offering. It's translated burnt offering. But the word itself means a going up. Okay? And so the reason it means a going up is it's the idea, first of all, that this whole thing is going up before the Lord. But secondly, it is symbolic of the fact that I am wholly dedicating myself to the Lord. All right? So, very, very important. If there were a series of sacrifices to be offered for the same particular event, I mean for some particular event, there was almost always a burnt offering included in the required list. All right, let's read in Leviticus 6 now. Go to Leviticus chapter 6. And we're going to start reading in verse 8. Leviticus 6, starting in verse 8. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law for the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth, on the altar, all night until the morning. And the fire on the altar is to be kept burning on it. The priest is to put on his linen robe, and he shall put on undergarments next to his flesh, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar, and place them beside the altar. Just picture all this as I'm reading it. Then he shall take off his garments and put on other garments and carry the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. And so Jesus, in Hebrews 13, it talks about how Jesus was offered outside the gate. And we need to, as it were, follow him outside the camp. You know, there's kind of something about becoming a Christian. We're kind of outsiders. Like, that's part of what we're signing up for. Okay? Verse 12, the fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out, but the priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall lay out the burnt offering on it and offer up and smoke the fat portions of the peace offerings on it. Fire shall be kept burning continually on the altar. It is not to go out. Now, here's what would happen if you were to bring a burnt offering. Okay? If you were to bring a burnt offering, the one doing the offering would lay his hands. So if you brought an animal to be offered, you would lay your hands on the head of the animal. What would that convey? That's right. This animal is dying on your behalf as a substitute for you. In other words, here's my best animal, the best one I have to give. I'm the one that deserves to be here, but I'm placing my hands on the head of this animal, and then you yourself would slit the animal's throat, and it would suffer and die. Are you feeling the personal connection? And then the animal would, you know, be flayed and cut up and so forth. I'll go into a little bit more of that detail. But I heard a preacher talk about one time, D. Bowman's son, to just kind of picture Jesus on the cross and your hands on his head. He is dying because of you, you know, because of me. He was our substitute. He took our place and became an offering to the Lord. Beautiful idea, but it's very challenging. It's very challenging as well. So the offerer would then kill and flay, strip off the skin of the animal. The priest, I love it when I'm right in the middle of a sentence. All right, the priest and the Levites performed this part of the process for the regular burnt offerings for the congregation. Then the priest sprinkled the blood round about upon the altar. So just picture all this. There's just blood everywhere. He cut the animal into pieces and laid some of the parts, including the head and the fat, directly upon the wood on the altar. He then washed the inward parts. That would make some of us queasy. I wouldn't be able to handle that. But he's just used to this. And so he's washing the innards and the legs before laying them upon the fire also. Then he burnt the entire animal in the fire as a sweet savor unto the Lord. Except for the skin, the animal was entirely burnt, and the ashes were taken outside the camp, as we read earlier, to a clean place. No one ate any portion of a burnt offering. Okay? So the priests weren't eating the meat like they did with some of these others. Okay? That's the burnt offering. Now, I've only got a couple minutes, so I want to touch on meal offerings here, or grain offerings. The King James calls these meat offerings, which has caused some people to be confused. First of all, I want to say this. The significance of the meal offering is uncertain. That's the last note that Waldron has in his section about meal offerings. And I got to that, and I thought, well, why didn't he tell me that first? You know, he waited till the end after I looked at all these details. The significance of the meal offering is uncertain. Okay? The specific significance, we just don't know. So I just want to state that. We don't know. But let's just look at what it was. When a flesh offering was made, whether a burnt offering or any other kind of sacrifice, a meal offering had to be given with it. Drink offerings were also required with the meal offerings. So anytime there was a flesh offering, there was also a meal offering and a drink offering. That was something I don't think I realized before this. Though sometimes the meal offering was offered by itself, the meal offering most often accompanied other sacrifices. The priest brought the offering before the Lord in front of the altar. He took a handful of flour and oil along with all the incense and burned that portion as a memorial to the Lord, as an aroma pleasing to the Lord. A meal offering given by a priest was all burned because it was counted as the Lord's share. But there are other times when meal offerings were consumed by the priest. How about that? Second, details of exactly what was offered, how it was offered, differs for the purpose of the sacrifice. I'm just not going to get into all those details, okay? What was one indispensable ingredient? Anybody remember?
Salt.
Salt. This is pretty fascinating. Look at Leviticus chapter 2 and verse 13. All right, Leviticus chapter 2 and verse 13. Every grain offering of yours, moreover, you shall season with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. According to Numbers 18 and verse 19, salt signified a covenant that could not be dissolved. I find it fascinating that Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth." And we can talk about salt and put our own meaning to that, but the first thought that would bring up to the Jew would be the salt in the meal offering. Frankincense always accompanied the meal offering, except in the meal offering of jealousy, described in Numbers chapter 5. What were forbidden as ingredients in the meal offering? Let's see who did that really remembered from their homework. Yeast and honey. That's just interesting. Okay. Okay, except for the memorial portion of the meal offering that was burned, all of this kind of offering normally went to the priest. The priests were to eat their portion cooked without yeast in the courtyard of the tabernacle. Okay, that's it. That's all I really want to cover about the meal offerings. And I got through all the material, so we don't really have time for comments. I hate that. Really hate that. We're out of time. But please read through the first paragraph of page 92 and all the corresponding scriptures for Wednesday. Thanks, everybody, for your attention.